Before you start listening to this podcast, we've got a special subscription offer. You can get 12 issues of The Spectator for £12, which will give you full access to everything on our website, and we'll also throw in a free £20 Amazon voucher. Just go to spectator.co.uk/voucher if you'd like to get this offer.
Hello and welcome to Coffee House Shots, The Spectator's daily politics podcast. I'm Cindy Yu and I'm joined by Katie Bors and James Forsyth. So it's week two of the national lockdown, but Professor Neil Ferguson of Imperial College today reports that the growth of coronavirus epidemic spreading in this country may be slowing. James, what's the story?
So what Neil Ferguson, who is one of the Imperial scientists who is behind the kind of the model that the government is using to determine its policy decisions, said on the Today programme this morning, is that although this isn't shown up in the official stats yet, there are signs that it is slowing down the spread of the coronavirus. Now, that suggests that the government's social distancing measures that it put into effect are having some effect on the spread of the disease. And we know that the government thinks that it would take 2 weeks for these effects to show up. But it's worth just going through the timetable a bit. So it's 17 days since the government said if you have any symptoms at all of coronavirus, you must stay at home and not go to work. It's 13 days since mass gatherings were cancelled. It's 10 days since the government basically said stay at home unless you have to leave. And it's a week since Boris Johnson said to the country, you know, that this was moving from a kind of voluntary request from the government to an instruction that could be enforced by the police. So I think that would suggest that there is some, that these measures might be beginning to have the effect that was intended. But it is worth noting that we've just had news that there have been another 159 coronavirus patients in England have died. And, you know, the death toll is now over 1,284. So I think it would be premature for anyone to think that we're heading towards the end of this. But Neil Ferguson's comments today are compatible with what we were talking about on Friday, which is that the government now thinks that the peak of this virus is likely to come in mid-April, not mid-May, that week beginning the 12th of April.
And indeed, Katie, yesterday, Jenny Harris, a Deputy Chief Medical Officer, said on the daily press conference that we might be heading for a six-month lockdown.
Yes, Jenny Harris was asked the question which everyone is being asked at the moment, which is how long must this go on for? So how long are people expected to stay in their households, to not go to work unless they really have to not socialise in, you know, groups outside of their own households? And even though, as James says, the government now believe the peak could come in April, there's still a sense, and it was very clear from the comments from Jenny Harris, that that doesn't mean people are going to suddenly be allowed out to have, you know, one big massive party. If anything, what's going to be happening is very kind of slow, phased reintroduction of, you know, I suppose, a return to normal society. And she was making the point that you would need to keep the measures in place even after the peak for a while. And you want to also get the impact of what effect all the social distancing is happening. So you need to have it in place for 2 to 3 weeks before you know if it's working, and then you decide from that how long you want to keep going. So I got the impression from listening to her speak that ultimately she was talking about 3 months potentially, but she did say this could run on for 6 months, said it could run even longer. But I got the impression that she was suggesting that the next 3 months could have quite strict social distancing, and then perhaps a relaxation, but a phased one, ultimately, coming in the coming months, where people would slowly be, you know, returned to a normal way of doing things.
One of the concerns in government circles is that if you lifted the social distancing rules all at once, we've only had a week of it, and already everyone is fed up with being cooped up inside. So you'd have huge numbers of people going out for a drink, going out for a meal, going to see their friends. And so that would be an abnormal event. And so that would increase the need. That would basically mean if there was coronavirus still in the system, this would give it another leash of life. So I think, as Katie said, what you are looking at, and what I think that you are looking at, as a kind of phasing out of these restrictions rather than a big bang moment where Boris Johnson appears on the TV and says, oh, all the things I told you in that televised address in March are now scrapped and you can go back to life as normal. I don't think that's the way it's going to be.
Now, Katie, on Friday, we were talking on the podcast about coronavirus reaching the heart of government when it transpired that Boris Johnson and Matt Hancock had both tested positive. Today, we hear that Dominic Cummings, the Prime Minister's chief advisor, is self-isolating because of symptoms. How many more infections do you think we can expect to see in the heart of Downing Street?
Well, clearly coronavirus is in, you know, the upper echelons of Westminster and the government. So I presume you will see quite a few more, because if you think about confined spaces, ultimately enough politicians now have it, enough advisors do, you expect it to spread. And this all comes back to the fact that we've known it's been in the House of Parliament for some time after Nadine Dorries became the first politician to at least go public saying that she had coronavirus. We also had over the weekend another cabinet minister, Alistair Jack, the Secretary of State for Scotland. He is also self-isolating. So I think it builds up to this picture. I think there are some questions if you speak to MPs about why they were told to keep going to Parliament, and not perhaps just going to Parliament, but if you think about the voting lobbies, if you think about how tight certain spaces are, Parliament and its age-old practices are not particularly coronavirus friendly when it comes to social distancing. So I think that you are potentially going to see more reluctance about the idea of, you know, when MPs are finally supposed to return to the Parliament after what could be an extended recess, what exactly they are expected to do, you know, in terms of certain practices. But in terms of the general operation, it clearly isn't particularly helpful if everyone is having to go and self-isolate. But it really depends on the level of symptoms. I think so many people have started working remotely already, and you can see from the cabinet last week that if people just have minor symptoms, it's not a huge impediment in terms of their workload. If, however, we don't have all the details, people, you know, are stuck in bed, they are unable to function normally, and that happens to a high proportion of the Prime Minister's team or the cabinet, that's clearly a much bigger problem.
Now, James, you wrote in your column last week that there's a deep anger within Downing Street over China's handling of the situation. And over the weekend, Michael Gove said on the Andrew Marr show this.
We've been increasing the number of tests over the course of the last month. It was the case, you were absolutely right, that the first case of coronavirus in China was established in December of last year, but it was also the case that some of the reporting from China was not clear about the scale, the nature, the infectiousness of this.
James, do you think this is something that we'll hear more about in the coming weeks?
Yes, I think we will, because I think no one is surprised in government that China attempted to cover up the disease. I think what there is real anger about is the kind of false narratives that China has been attempting to spread about where the disease started, the attempt to kind of pin the blame on the US. And I also think there's a feeling that a lot of this supposed China generosity to Europe is very much all for show and not what it seems. You know, look at the number of tests that have been had to be sent back, or masks that have had to be not used because they aren't of a high enough standard. And I think there is a feeling that China has behaved very badly. And then someone also in Downing Street was saying to me, you know, there is also a difference here, because some people say, oh, it's ridiculous to blame people for, you know, it's victim blaming to talk about where a virus started. I mean, that's not right in this case, because SARS should have been a massive warning to China that these so-called wet wildlife markets are just unsanitary and should be stopped. And, you know, it's not like China is a land of civil liberties where you can't stop people from doing this, because they've been, you know, the Chinese state clearly has the power and the authority to do that if it wanted to, and it chose not to take the warning. And the warning has resulted in another virus getting going. And this virus is not just causing economic damage to China. Indeed, it may well cause far greater economic damage in Europe than it caused in China. And I think that people are understandably angry about that, understandably angry about the way in which China is attempting to look like it is being this kind of benevolent actor, you know, sending supplies to Serbia, you know, sending masks to Holland that turn out not to be of sufficient quality. And I think it has just reminded people that the desire to pretend that China is just another country, just another part of the world economy, is wrong. It remains a totalitarian dictatorship that is becoming progressively less liberal, not more liberal. And, you know, that President Xi is not someone that the West can do business with.
And Katie, in the rather long term, what do you think this means for Boris Johnson's position on Huawei?
Well, Boris Johnson was already going against a lot of opposition on Huawei. And if you try and think back to slightly pre-coronavirus being the only story in town days, we saw the Huawei rebellion where they didn't have enough to pass the amendment that was put forward, and the charge was led by David Davis. But it did get very close for a government that has a majority of 80, and I think probably thought they were fairly untouchable. So I think it was a reminder that actually there's a lot of hostility in the party already, and even before coronavirus and what that means to geopolitical relations with China, those rebels leading the charge were quite confident from how close they got that they have until the summer, which is in theory could be even longer at this rate, to have the legislation on Huawei. They'd be able to recruit more MPs to their side. Now, I think that recent events mean that they'll find that task fairly easy. And the question is, does the government move itself, or do they wait for what I think has a good chance of being a successful rebellion?
I was talking to one of the grandees involved in this rebellion, and they said that, you know, they A, think the numbers at the time were not as large as they could have been because the rebels didn't go all out to get numbers. And secondly, they think the numbers have swelled because of recent events. And now, I still think you could buy off the vast majority of these rebels with just simply a date for when the Huawei kit would be removed and replaced by an alternative vendor. But once you commit to a date, you actually have to start taking action to get there. And the political problem for Boris Johnson is that it's not just not putting Huawei kit into 5G, it's having to take Huawei kit out of the existing network. So it's not just that people would have to wait longer for 5G, their current levels of mobile broadband would go down.
James and Katie, thanks very much. And to hear more about relations with China post-coronavirus, why not check out The Spectator's weekly podcast, The Edition. In the latest episode, James and Katie talk to William Hague, former Foreign Secretary during the David Cameron years, when we were going for a golden era with China. To find it, just search for The Edition wherever you get your podcasts from. Thanks for listening, and join us again tomorrow.